Welcome to the TSP podcast, Sociology 101. The Society Pages, or TSP, is an open access social science project headquartered in the Department of Sociology at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities. Our main goal is to bring the social sciences to a broader audience. My name is Daniel Cueto Villalobos, and I study race, religion, and politics here at the University of Minnesota. I'm currently working on my dissertation, which examines white anti-racism within progressive churches.
And I'm Forrest Levett. I'm a PhD student at the University of Minnesota. I study religion, political behavior, and morality. We are pleased to welcome Dr. Samuel Perry today. Dr. Perry is an award-winning author and professor at the University of Oklahoma. His research interests include religion, culture, race, ethnicity, politics, families, and sexual behavior. He has published over 100 articles and authored or co-authored 5 books. He is also a frequent contributor to Time magazine and has appeared in other major outlets like The Washington Post and NBC News.
We'd love to just dig into you and yourself here. So we want to, start off by hearing a bit just about, your own intellectual trajectory and specifically what led you to study Christian nationalism. Like I mentioned before, we both have extensive experiencing Christian nationalism ourselves through conservative evangelical churches, me in Southern California, and Forrest also, I believe, in Southern California,
right? Yeah, I briefly worked for a mega church that shall not be named in Southern California and also grew up in Alabama, so I don't need to say more about that experience.
So anyways, these experiences really do bear on our current intellectual work, right? So I'm wondering if you could share a bit about, what led you to study religion, Christian nationalism. And also, we're interested in, I guess, maybe seeing if there's a line to be drawn between your dissertation work, what you studied as a graduate student at UChicago, and what you're studying today. Is there a connection there? I'll let you take it away.
Yeah, so I think there's two parts of our initial interest in Christian nationalism. In mine in particular, it comes from, I think, what many people who end up studying religion share, which is some kind of experience, personal experience with religion. There's been several recent studies showing that people who study religion as social scientists are more likely to have that in their background themselves. They're more likely to either be religious or have some kind of personal connection. And that should be no surprise. Like we always study things that are relevant to us personally. That's a very common observation. So I have an evangelical background. I have a seminary degree from an evangelical flagship seminary. And since undergrad, honestly, though, I've always been fascinated with the integration of like American culture with American Christianity. And what got me initially interested in that was the issue of race. I come from an interracial family, and my parents were evangelicals, and we adopted African-American sisters when I was 4 years old. And so I was always fascinated by just the reality that the American church, especially the evangelical church, is this famously racist institution that has defended racism and white supremacy in all kinds of ways. And I found that to be endlessly fascinating. I mean, horrible, but just as intellectually fascinating. Just how could a religion that I was always taught was based on love and tolerance and sacrificing for others be so characterized by intolerance? And I felt like, well, there must be something about like the integration of American culture with American Christianity in ways that augment both of those things. So theoretically, I think that really informs my interest in what Christian nationalism is and has been. Empirically, we backed into it completely. So this is not something that, so Andrew Whitehead and I started studying this back in 2013. I still had the emails where we were initially going back and forth about like, what are we looking at here? We were playing around with the Baylor Religion Survey, which had these measures on it about what Paul Froese, I think, had called secularization idea. I played around with, but we were finding that the more Americans subscribed to statements like, or they affirm statements like the United States should be a Christian nation, or they declare itself a Christian nation, and no separation of church and state and prayer in public schools. One of the first papers we wrote out of that was this really interesting finding that the more white Americans in particular affirmed that, those statements, the more likely they were to oppose interracial marriage across the, like against Asians, Latinos, Black Americans. Like, And that to me was just like, what is this? What, how is this possibly a connection? These questions say nothing about race, nothing about ethnicity. It's only about like Christian nation, Christian values, and all those kinds of things. And yet it seems to be strongly associated with a pretty explicit racial prejudice of opposition to interracial marriage. And so I said, there's got to be something more here that we've got to dig into. There's got to be some kind of dynamic about, for white Americans in particular, the idea of a Christian nation and Christian heritage that is conflating with racial identity and ethnic identity. And so we were just like graduate students. I was a graduate student at the time at Chicago. And so I think like we all do is we play around with data and we try to see what's an interesting story there, what's worth talking about. And so this really dovetailed a lot with the kinds of things I was already interested in exploring. And then Trump came along and then it just became all the more reason to study these things, using his rhetoric and his kind of references to bringing power back to Christians. Now, this really didn't have anything to do with my dissertation necessarily. My dissertation was a qualitative dissertation of again, speaking about how we study things that are relevant to us personally. It was a qualitative exploration of the evangelical orphan care movement. I'd begun to notice that evangelical families were kind of making a name and becoming famous. And there was all this press about evangelicals adopting children. And lots of children, as many children as possible, from foster care and internationals, things. And I wanted to understand what the movement had done to try to mobilize all of these Christian families to do this. And it ended up finding, as often happens in qualitative work, I found just the opposite. I found that the movement had done nothing, essentially, other than just mobilize Christians to kind of talk a lot and host conferences and do all this effort to kind of describe themselves in these terms. But when I dug into the stories of these families who had adopted children, I interviewed hundreds of them, flew around the country, went to all these events, and I found that almost all of them, their stories just start with infertility. They wanted children, they couldn't have them. Adoption was like the last thing that they wanted to do. But then once they got involved with this movement, they learned what we call vocabularies of motives. That's C. Wright Mills' term. They learned these vocabularies of motives to kind of describe what they were doing in Christian-y language. And apparently it had fooled all the journalists and all the social scientists like myself who wanted to study these kinds of things. And so my first book coming out of that, Growing God's Family, was really about how evangelical activism, for a lot of the reasons I identify in this dissertation, is self-limiting in a lot of ways. It's more of a religious movement than a social movement, even though oftentimes evangelicals get involved in social activism, like about sex trafficking, or adoption, or you know, foster caring. Very rarely do they move the needle in any kind of significant way, because it really is, for them, it's more about defining who they are as a people, signaling to one another that this is what we stand for and this is what we're about. And if they do make any kind of changes, it's usually a flash in the pan kind of trend thing. It's not something that is sustainable because it's not structural. It's not built into like what it means to be an evangelical. After the book, put that to bed and then kind of moved on to other research on pornography, which has been one strand of research. But then Christian nationalism has been the focus for the last four or five years.
Great. Thank you for all that. I think it's really helpful, especially, you know, Soch 101, the podcast really does aim itself toward, you know, undergraduates and aspiring grad students and grad students who are, you know, in the process of dissertating, you know, and sometimes it's hard to appreciate that, you know, what we see as our dissertation doesn't always define us, right? Like, you know, right. It's just a jumping off point for a larger body of research. So I really appreciate that.
Feel free to, hopefully this goes without saying, but feel free to like, you know, if I'm just going on for like 10 minutes, feel free to cut and rework and reposition anything that you need, whatever you find most helpful, or don't use it. You know, like it won't offend me at all.
Yeah, sounds good. Thank you.
Yeah, that kind of leads to the next question, talking about the role that race plays. So if you could just, I know you've probably done it a million times, but broadly define Christian nationalism. And just thinking, because in the book, it sometimes, like in the title, it has white Christian nationalism, and then sometimes it's just Christian nationalism. So are those used interchangeably, or is there a difference between the two?
Right. So this is one of the most important, I think, nuances that we've added in the last few years to our discussion of Christian nationalism. So when Andrew Whitehead and I first started studying this phenomenon called Christian nationalism, we just refer to it as such, as Christian nationalism, and refer to this really generic or general, you know, what Andrew calls a cultural framework, I think in terms more of like an ideology that idealizes and advocates a fusion of American civic life with a very particular kind of Christianity. That's Christian nationalism generally. But that, notice I said a particular kind of Christianity, right? So there's this is where the whiteness part comes in. And I think within the last few years, we've identified that what we're actually talking about is we're talking about something completely different when it comes to white Americans as it does for, say, people of color, and specifically African Americans and Hispanic Americans. We don't call it white Christian nationalism now to make it sound scary or to associate it with white nationalism. We do that because empirically we find that when white Americans affirm the same questions that we ask about Christian nation, Christian values, Christian heritage, all those things, it seems to correlate strongly. Power. It's and when I say strongly, I mean it's like the strongest predictor in the models usually. It correlates strongly with ethnocentrism, authoritarian violence, anti-democratic politics, really kind of authoritarian ethno-nationalist populism kind of feelings.
Yeah.
But for people of color, it doesn't, right? It just doesn't. So Black Americans can affirm the exact same questions on those surveys, and it either does nothing, like it doesn't change their political attitudes, doesn't change their views on race or violence or those kind of, or guns. In some ways, and sometimes it actually goes in the opposite direction, right? Mm. So I'll give you an example of that. Christopher Cito, who is a graduate of Penn State and he's a professor at Purdue, he and I have a couple of papers that we're working on together, and we're looking at, say, GSS data, and which has Christian nationalism measures now, and so we were looking at how Christian nationalism corresponds with a rejection of gun permits, like people don't want to buy gun permits. So if you're a white American, the more you subscribe to Christian nationalism, the more you don't like gun permits, the you reject them. You don't feel like that should be law or that kind of thing. But if you're African American or Hispanic, the more you subscribe to Christian nationalism, the more you like the idea of gun permits, right? Like it's because it's like protecting your community, right? So I'll give you another example. These are all studies that have not come out. These are under peer review right now. Well, another example is what I'm working on with Landon Chabel and a graduate student of mine. We look at whether or not Americans, when we ask them the question, should we prioritize as a society liberty or equality? Right, that's a really important question. Like all democracies live in that kind of tension between liberty and equality. Right. And we find that the more white Americans subscribe to Christian nationalism, the more they're likely to affirm liberty. That's the most important thing, right? Like that because there's this white libertarian, what Gerardo Marty calls kind of a white libertarianism impulse in Christian nationalism. But if you're an African American, and especially if you're an African American woman, the more you subscribe to Christian nationalism, the more you say equality is what we should be prioritizing. Why? Well, because for a Black woman, there's this kind of intersectional dynamic going on. A Christian nation is one that includes you, finally, right? Like, is one that is equal. And so all that to say, when we're talking about Christian nationalism, I try to nuance it now by talking about white Christian nationalism, because empirically, what we're talking about with this, the association with Trump support and the xenophobia and the Islamophobia and the ethnocentrism and the anti-democratic politics and the authoritarian populist kind of impulse, is really only found among white Americans primarily. Right. It's not among people of color. And so I think that is a nuance that absolutely has to be dug down into. And can I give you one more example of one that I'm working on? So this is one we just collected. So this is new data that we just got a couple of weeks ago, a national survey that we fielded. What is her? Ashley Jardina. Ashley Jardina, who is a political scientist at Virginia now, she wrote a now famous book called White Identity Politics. And what she found is that the more white Americans affirm their own whiteness, they're proud of being white, they have white racial consciousness and solidarity with other white Americans, they believe white Americans should advocate on behalf of other white Americans, politics and those kinds of things. The more you subscribe to that kind of views as a white American, the more you hold certain political views, you're more likely to get involved in politics and all that. And so I wondered, okay, well, how does Christian nationalism play into this kind of thing? And I found that the more a white American subscribes to Christian nationalism, the more likely they are to affirm white racial consciousness and solidarity measures, but only white Americans. It doesn't happen among Hispanics or other race Americans. And in fact, for Black Americans, the more they subscribe to Christian naturalism, the less likely they were to affirm kind of Black racial consciousness and solidarity. Mm-hmm. In the opposite direction completely. White Christian nationalism is quite frankly the politics of whiteness, or it is the political ideology of white identity politics. I feel like these kinds of examples have convinced me that race and religion in the United States are fundamentally connected. Penny Edgell wrote co-edited a volume with Grace Jukic called "Religion as Raced," and I think that's undeniably true. Religion in the United States is fundamentally racialized.
Yeah, thank you for that. And I think that, you know, the nuance you provide, thinking about how Black and white Americans respond so differently when it comes to religion and their views about politics, it really does get to the point of, you know, thinking about religion as, you know, social groups, right? Like these are social right. dynamics that respond to, you know, ostensibly the same text, right? But given the differences in life experience and lived experiences, you know, those lead to very different ends. I'm wondering if I could just follow up on this thread here, thinking about how, you know, today we see, you know, news reports about Trump gaining support from, you know, increasing numbers of Black Americans, Hispanic Americans, among immigrants. You know, we were surprised in the 2020 election to see a growth in vote share along the U.S.-Mexico border for Trump. How do you make sense of that? You know, thinking about Christian nationalism, how does Christian nationalism play out? And does it help us explain that phenomenon?
Yeah, I think it can in some interesting ways. So for Black Americans, for Black Americans, I think the less connected they are to the historic Black Protestant tradition, which was highly race conscious and centered on racial identity and very connected to a sense of advocating for the community, and which historically led them to vote Democrat strongly. Black Americans are disaffiliating as fast as white Americans, especially Black men. And we find that when white Americans secularize, they tend to liberalize and become more they become more partisan toward Democrats. When Black Americans secularize, and especially Black men, when they secularize, they don't liberalize. They become less conservative, they become less partisan towards the Democrats. And so Black Americans are not becoming Republicans in mass, they're becoming independents, especially Black men. And so that means that they are now in play. So secularization is working its sorting magic for white Americans and for Black Americans, but it's doing it in different ways. And so Christian nationalism doesn't help us understand, so like what's going on with, say, Black Americans and Trump support in that way. Right. So secularization, I think, is actually moving Black Americans towards independence and so that they're no longer partisan Democrats. But some other dynamic that I want to explore in future research, and we're doing this a little bit right now, is how Christian nationalism in some ways can build what I call multi-ethnic coalitions of exclusion. I fibbed a little bit when I said that Christian nationalism works one way for white Americans and a different way for people of color. It doesn't always do that. So it does usually when it comes to authoritarian violence and guns and race and those kinds of things. But on issues of family, gender, and sexuality, it actually works almost identical for white, Black, and Hispanic Americans.
Interesting.
So what that means is if Black Americans and Hispanic Americans subscribe to Christian nationalist ideology as white Americans, surveys, and it seems to push them in the same direction when it comes to issues of gender identity and sexual orientation issues or civil rights for sexual minorities or family, then as a politician, hitting those notes, right, like hitting the idea of hitting the wedge issues of transgender ideology, the wedge issues of the LGBTQ community, can actually serve to unite Black Christian nationalists and white Christian nationalists in a way that they're on the same team suddenly, right? So for white Americans for white American politicians to to talk about immigration or Black Lives Matter is a strategic wedge because it divides the Black community and the Hispanic community. But for them to talk about family, gender, identity, and sexual orientation issues is actually something that unites all of these conservative Christians together. And so I think that could also help account for some of the pull that Trump is able to see. One of the things that has taken place since 2020, Trump really leans hard into this idea of like socialism. And it's just something that doesn't really score big for him. In all of his rhetoric, he tries to talk about socialism, the Democrats are socialists, all those kinds of things. It doesn't really work for him. But what has been working in the GOP over the last few years now is the issue of wokeness and not just CRT, but wokeness as this kind of leftist, radical leftist ideology that is not just about race, but is even more about things like gender identity and LGBTQ issues. And to the extent that you can get conservative Black churchgoers who subscribe to Christian nationalism in some kind of way on board with the idea that, like, you know what, the Democratic Party is the party of just transitioning children and gender affirming care and all of these kinds of ideas that are just not are not mainstream yet. I think they're able to score big politically. And that's what they're doing now.
And it's part of a larger playbook, right? Like we, this is very similar to kind of what we saw during the Cold War. A lot of kind of these moral panics that are, you know, usefully weaponized.
Always.
Yeah.
Always having to do with schools, always having to do with families, always having to do with, you know, who your children are playing around with. You got to protect the children, right? Like it's all that kind of, and it's unassailable because how are you going to argue with that kind of thing? Parents' rights to like protect their children and they're fearful and they're defending those kinds of things. I mean, it is, and we are an extremely polarized society in our rhetoric. It's not that we are moving towards extremes. It's that the loudest voices are on the extremes and they give the impression that, man, there's just two options. Either you hate one side or you hate the other side. And your rhetoric has to be that severe either way.
Yeah.
So in the book, The Flag and the Cross, one thing that you mentioned that stood out was calling COVID-19 an asteroid. And I think that comes from Jonathan Haidt's reference to an asteroid. But thinking of COVID-19 and some of these other social issues or events that kind of exacerbated the asteroid of COVID-19, talking about George Floyd, the 2020 election, the big lie. And of course, you mentioned January 6th in the book as well. Can you just speak more about like COVID's impact on the U.S. civil society, but with the context of these other interrelated events? And what you particularly say is that unlike Jonathan Haidt's prediction, like COVID didn't unite us. So thinking about, we just wanted to include some of those other events that, you know, COVID didn't occur in a vacuum. So can you say more about how Christian nationalism played a part in that?
I think COVID-19 and our response to COVID-19 as a nation is indicative of just where we are culturally. And Christian nationalism played a role in Christian nationalism played a role in exacerbating that situation as it amplifies polarization and makes the situation all the more worse in terms of say election issues and George Floyd, COVID-19, all of those kinds of things. Because what it is, and we found this in recent studies that we are seeing published now, is that Christian nationalism amplifies polarization because it is fundamentally about an us versus them dynamic, about the people that are trying to take what is ours and our responsibility and obligation to fight to take it back from them. That's why we named our first book "Taking America Back for God," because that really is the narrative: is that this idea that the left or the seculars have taken what is rightfully ours, and we've got to mobilize politically to be able to take that kind of thing back. As a matter of fact, recent experimental work by a couple of different studies has found that Christian nationalism it grows in response to the perception of loss, to the idea of threat, like demographic decline. If Christians are in decline, white Americans, white Christians will respond with greater Christian nationalism because it is a response to something they feel like is being taken. Now, so with things like COVID-19, George Floyd, the election denialism, all those kinds of things, what you see is you see a couple of dynamics at work with Christian nationalism, because it is Christian nationalism, I think, is a religion that goes hand in hand with like authoritarian populism and ethno-nationalism in the United States. It is connected to belief in conspiracy theory. It is connected to a belief in a persecution, constant persecution, that they were always in this state of emergency. And this goes into what the Americans that we find subscribe to Christian nationalism the most are those who are Pentecostal, holiness traditions, those who would already think in terms of like end times, cosmic battles between good and evil and globalist conspiracies out to take, and persecute the elect of Jesus. So you've got this narrative already, a suspicion of governments coming together to unite to fight a common foe. And there's already this kind of anti-elite kind of rut. But with COVID-19, you've got the partisan element. So Donald Trump is the president of white Christian nationalists in the United States. He comes under attack from the Democrats and the left, saying you're not doing enough. And Trump says, no, this is nothing. COVID-19, it's overblown. It's not a big deal. We don't need to shut down the economy. The cure is going to be worse than the disease. So immediately becomes a partisan thing, and Christian nationalism becomes a part of that story. But you also have these scientists coming in, these academics, these medical professionals, these elites, the media, telling us we need to wear masks and we need to lock down. And already there's that triggers another level of like suspicion and populist kind of response to that kind of thing. And so we found in our study back in 2021 that one of the key predictors of whether or not you followed mask mandates or you stayed locked down or whether you just disregarded that and met with people in public was Christian nationalism and your commitment to saying like, hey, you know, my only authority is God, not the government. I'm not going to do all these kinds of things. And after that, we have found Christian nationalism associated with anti-vax attitudes. And just in general, even before COVID-19, surveys were showing this. After COVID-19, there's actually been several studies that showed that Christian nationalism was associated with not wanting to take the vaccine and eventually not taking it in that kind of way. Again, because of conspiracy, anti-science, populist, Trump-loving kind of partisanship. And I think that's one. COVID-19 is just one example, though, of how Christian nationalism plays into like Americans' kind of hyper-polarized rhetoric and scene, and amplifies it and makes it worse. And one of the reasons it does make it worse is because Christian nationalism, especially white Christian nationalism, represents the overlap of several different identities: Christian, nation, white, in a way that amplifies intolerance towards the other. And so with that, comes kind of fear of Islam, fear of immigrants, fear of it's connected with anti-Semitism, certainly, and fear of leftist seculars, anybody who stays outside of that kind of category of who are the real American patriot.
And it really leads people to, like we saw on January 6th, to, you know, take America back, you know, quite literally take up arms to return this country to themselves. Right.
Right. Well, we found in our book, The Flag and the Cross, there's a connection between white Christian nationalism and authoritarian violence, not just violence per se. It's not like people who subscribe to Christian nationalism, we didn't really feel like we didn't show in that book that they were more kind of like indigenous violence. They're violent people. But it was righteous violence. It was ordered violence. It was violence for the sake of maintaining the social order. Paul Jupe, who's a political scientist at Denison University, who's doing some great work with Christian nationalism as well, they have a book coming out within the next couple of years where they show that really there's this combination between Christian nationalism and what they call apocalyptic thinking. The idea that there's a battle between good and evil, that Satan and the powers of evil are on the planet, and there's this kind of fight that we're all building up to. When you combine those things, Christian national, the kind of the grievance politics of Christian nationalism, that something has been taken from us, we're under attack, with that kind of cosmic stakes and eternal, us versus them battle, that's when you really get the kind of violent rhetoric. Those are the people who most likely to endorse the violence, the people who combine the apocalyptic mindset with this kind of Christian nationalist ideology.
Right.
Yeah, very interesting. Saw that with Sean Foyt and Eric Metaxas with the kind of counter protest they were doing at Columbia. And their approach was that it is the end days, you know, so this is just a sign of the coming of the Lord to them. So, yeah, it's definitely true. The next question is kind of for taking the Christian nationalist perspective of the other, the outside group of, it could be secular progressives, leftists, or people that are spiritual but not religious or formerly religious, like any of us, what could we do to slow the spread of Christian nationalism, if there's anything we can do?
Yeah, sure. So I think one of the key ways, and this is what I tell my students, is it has to be defeated politically, because I and when I say politically, I don't just mean that it's about policy, because some of these folks are just absolute grifters. Like, they have no desire to kind of change policy in any kind of way. They just use this as rhetoric, but they use it as rhetoric because it's effective politically. So when I say defeat this politically, I mean that the politicians who use this kind of rhetoric as a grift, they use this as to like sow anger and fear and anxiety, and they don't talk about policy. They talk about woke leftists. They talk about porn in public schools, and they talk about like school choice or whatever the kind of like buzzword is. The politicians who use that kind of rhetoric need to be defeated, so that politicians in the future know that, like, hey, that kind of rhetoric does not fly with American people. They don't want it, right? Yeah. It doesn't score points. When that kind of rhetoric scores points politically, they will lean into it. When you have like a Marjorie Taylor Greene or a Lauren Boebert or somebody who's able to, or a Carrie Lake, or somebody who's able to punch above their weight politically, certainly above their qualification and influence, they're able to get this kind of national attention through that kind of rhetoric. They're going to keep on doing it. In Oklahoma, we have several politicians who are making a national name for themselves by basically being outspoken Christian nationalists. You've got Dusty Devers, who is a state senator. You've got Ryan Walters, who is our state superintendent of public instruction, who honestly doesn't do a whole lot, right? Like, he doesn't do a lot. Like, it's not like he's changing all of these kinds of things. He's a grifter, right? So he goes on Fox News and he makes a name for himself and he tweets things and he gets the libs of TikTok lady to retweet him. I mean, like, he does all these things because he's building a platform for himself. It's not about policy. It's about using that kind of rhetoric to sow anger and fear and anxiety among a bunch of very scared and probably ignorant white working class people who just feel distracted by all of that.
Yeah.
And so that has to, like, people, one of the ways we defeat this is by making sure that does not win, that's not the kind of politics that carries the day. It is a politics of depolarizing in ways. And what I mean by that is I just mean somebody has to be the adult in the room eventually, right? Like, somebody has to talk about democracy. Somebody has to talk about rights and freedoms for all people. And so I'm committed to the idea that I can fight evil and evil politics and evil ideologies. I can do that without hating people and demonizing and dehumanizing people and talking about people on the far right as like vermin or whatever. I'm miss me with that stuff. I don't do that at all. Like, I want, these are human beings who also have rights, but also need to recognize that, like, people are not going to tolerate this kind of like quasi-fascist kind of like rhetoric that ends up getting into it. And so I think one of the ways that this goes down is defeating it at the polls. I think also is shining a light on it in an intelligent way. I don't want to shy back. Like, the phrase Christian nationalism is becoming kind of it's becoming amorphous, obviously. Like, it's you know, we keep having to define it over and over again because people keep using it. Like, and they use it to mean anything. Any politics like to the right of me is Christian nationalism. Any Christians voting their values is Christian nationalism. That's never what we've advocated for, and that's not what we want to do. And I don't think that's helpful ultimately. So I think it's for social scientists, it's us defining our terms clearly and doing careful research and talking about not going beyond what the research says and doesn't say, being open to critique when appropriate, and making our studies better. And yet at the same time, man, calling it out when we see it. Like, if I tell people all the time, like, you know, people have said like, hey, there's this backlash and people are now embracing the term Christian nationalist because we talk about it too much. And now they're just kind of like a basket of deplorables mm-hmm. mood in 2016. And my response to that, honestly, is like, you know, if I call a group of white supremacists out and say, hey, that's white supremacy. And they say, well, just because you said that, I'm going to do white supremacy even harder now. I would still call it out, right? Like I would still say that's my responsibility to say that that's what that is and not feel like, well, I don't want to hurt your feelings because you're going to white supremacy harder now. Like I don't want to shy away from that. If it is that. And so like, I think we can be truthful and yet at the same time, treat people like citizens with equal rights and mm-hmm. tone down the hate and the rhetoric and actually get to know people and build relationships. I want to recommend a book that I recommend to everybody. It's a book by a guy named Eitan Hersh, who's a political scientist at Tufts University, and it's called Politics is for Power. And that's a weird title, but basically what he's advocating for is that like real politics is not doom scrolling on social media for 3 hours and reading a bunch of national news and then just saying I did politics for the day. Like real politics involves interacting with people. It involves going door to door. It involves voting. It involves civic responsibility. I try to encourage my students to get into that, not doom scrolling, not national news, local politics, getting involved in some kind of meaningful way, actually building relationships. I think that's what we have to lean into.
I agree with you. And I agree that Christian nationalism must be defeated at the ballot box. But I also recognize that Christian nationalism and a lot of this polarization has really benefited from a lot of the structural facets, you know, in our governmental institutions, also the media and social media, and you know, the fact that this stuff sells and people are, you know, you mentioned the grifters, but this is a profitable enterprise at the end of the day. And I think, you know, we have to defeat it at the ballot box, but we also have to really push our elected officials to change a lot of the policies that have, you know, perpetuated this and have led to this extensive polarization, be it, you know, the rule that used to be in place, the name is escaping me right now, but where, you know, news channels had to provide, you know, fair coverage of an issue and present both sides of a topic. Things like that I think that, you know, have really been kind of, have really fallen by the wayside. But I wanted to shift gears really quickly here and talk about, you know, the deep stories that you talk about. So you borrow, Hochschild's concept there, and the role that deep stories and other, you know, cultural objects play in Christian nationalism. You know, we're thinking about the cross and the flag here as kind of yeah. those two there. And there's the deep story of, un-American coming and taking my job, you know, that notion really fueling a lot of this there. I'm wondering how, you know, thinking about this as, progressive social scientists who are committed to, you know, preserving democracy in the United States. I know a very controversial take here. How can progressives, you know, I guess, re-co-opt or, you know, use these symbols that are very, you know, powerful to Americans? How can we do that? What are some folks doing to that end? Is it possible or, you know, have the flag and the cross really been co-opted by the religious right? What can we do?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think I am personally not like I'm not opposed to the idea of patriotism. Like I think that's a good thing, and I actually think it's and you could call it. I mean, I think there's all kinds of words for it. Like people call like white Christian nationalism what we call it kind of an ethno-nationalism, but there's also a famously a kind of a civic nationalism. Phil Gorski, my co-author. He's actually a fan of the idea of civil religion, you know, the civil religious tradition as something that has been good, not because it's sectarian. It's like Bella's concept of civil religion was that it's not sectarian. It did draws on Christian language symbolism, but basically it was about this idea that America has an obligation to whatever power gave us all of these kinds of like great resources and these blessings, and we have a stewardship responsibility to be a just and equitable society. And you can see this even in Obama's like rhetoric and inaugural addresses and presidency that we have this kind of obligation to whatever power God, he calls it God, but we have this obligation to kind of, to be just, to be good stewards of the environment, all those kinds of things. If not, those blessings may go away, right? So you could be a secular person and subscribe to that idea. There is this kind of a unifying creed that brings us together. Jill Lepore, who is one of my favorite historians, she wrote a book called This America, The Case for the Nation. It's a very short book. It's a great book. I actually really like it a lot. Stephen Smith, who is a political scientist, political theorist at Yale, he wrote a book called Enlightened Patriotism. It's a book on enlightened patriotism that he wrote within the last 4 years. But both of them are arguing for the same idea that there is creedal values that we share as Americans that really can unite us. I am sympathetic with the Christian nationalist complaint or concern that if Christianity goes away, what unites us as a nation? Right. Like, that's a fair question to ask. Like, if it's not like some kind of Christian identity, what does unite us as a nation? I think it can be the foundational ideas. Abraham Lincoln articulated that what undergirded the principles of the Constitution was the initial sentences of the Declaration of Independence. We hold these truths to be self-evident. All men are created equal, endowed by their creator with inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. To protect these rights, citizens establish government. So you've got right there the idea of full legal equality. You've got the idea of government by the people, right? Democracy. You've got the idea of limited government, that the people are in charge of the government, not the government in charge of the people, right? Like, they can't tell us what to, like, our own religion and all those kinds of things. And so I'm fully on board with Americans uniting around this kind of common commitment to what I think are really awesome principles, right? Like, really great creedal commitments that of legal equality, limited government, government by the people, liberal democracy. So I hope that we Ruth Braunstein, who's a fantastic sociologist of religion, he writes about these things a lot. She also points out the problem that progressives have lost the fight again and again about, like, telling good stories, mm-hmm. and having good narratives and stories about who we are as a people and what is going on in the country. And movements on the right have just nailed that, right? Like, they have this kind of stories of, like, decline and, you know, something, you know, restoration that they see in the future. And the left just doesn't have anything in comparison. I hope we can develop kind of a narrative story about who we are as a people and what unites us in a way that actually sounds appealing, and it doesn't sound like exactly what the right wants us to sound like, which is like, hey, this kind of globalist floating, we are all just animals, that kind of, not united by any kind of thing other than just hedonism, right? Like, that's right. That doesn't win politically. It just doesn't. And nor is I think where I'd want to go anyways, but I just think we can do better.
Yeah. I mean, I think to that point, it's, and to what you mentioned, repeating Ruth's point, Ruth Braunstein, the fact is that, the left is so much more diverse religiously, right. Racially, nationally. Right. There are fewer, I guess, through lines or, unifying points there, which is a strength, I think. But right. At the same time, in terms of the project of creating a shared creed, a shared set of values that unifies us, that makes it challenging.
Right.
And, it's finding that answer is very challenging. Did you want to go to the one about, I think we have one final question here, but kind of thinking about more contemporarily.
Yeah. And in the present context of, just wondered what you thought of the findings of the book and your, all of your other work, and how they are applicable to current events, like, what's happening right now with Trump's legal troubles or Speaker Johnson's, like, proud Christian nationalism. What would you say to those type of developments or others that are happening, and how that, like, plays into, what we're seeing with, just being more outspoken, I guess. Like you mentioned, Marjorie Taylor Greene, Lauren Boebert, now we have a Speaker of the House who has a appeal to heaven flag outside of his office. So can you speak more to that?
Yeah. So I think a lot, you know, and we don't want to, every election, it seems like we talk about, like, this is the most important election in the history of the, of the country, and people get tired of that. And I understand why. It just sounds like hype after a while, or just, you know, liberal academic kind of hand wringing about the state of things. I think what I'm trying to convince people of is that, like, we really have made things better over time with, and it hasn't just happened naturally. It's not some kind of like an evolutionary story where it just naturally inclines towards that. It happened with good institutions and good governance and us making responsible choices to do the right thing as citizens. It happens when we don't give in to kind of our more base kind of inclinations to hate people, to vilify people, to demonize people. Like, when I said it earlier in the podcast, but, like, you know, at the end of the day, people committed to liberal democracy have to be the adults in the room. And that's hard, man. Like, that is hard. Yeah, 'cause it just sucks sometimes. Like, you just see people saying with zero accountability lies all day long and blatantly using this kind of, like, hate-filled rhetoric and intolerance to be able to score political points, and you want to combat that, right? Like, you want to take out hate, you want to say, like, oh, it's, you know, and you want to join and just overwhelm them with that kind of same thing. I think it will require academics, hopefully, leading the way here, but it will also require citizens, responsible citizens, saying, we can make this democracy lasting and beautiful and better. By committing to building solid institutions and being the kind of citizens that we want to that we want to see lead and take the voice, there will be lots of people on the left and the right who are not fans of that kind of approach, right? Like, because that, you know, it's they're angry, and I get it. They're scared, and I get that too. But I think. What happens in November, a lot does hang on it. And I hope that in the response, I hope Trump goes down, obviously. I hope he goes down in a number of ways, politically, in all the kind of criminal ways that he could possibly go down. But I mainly hope that goes down, not because I hate Donald Trump so much, but because I think that needs to signal all of the white supremacists and ethno-nationalists and people who came out of the woodwork following his success in 2016, who said, "Ooh, this plays now. We can go back. We can move the Overton window and start saying racist things again." Mm-hmm. I want that to lose big time, and I just want our national discourse to go back to where it was, and better, in a way that we can, I think, productively talk about all the problems that face us as a society, like climate change and COVID-19 and future pandemics and food insecurity and world peace in ways that we can actually solve global problems. So I think that'll require all of us to take responsibility in a way.
Great. Thank you, Sam. Well, we're at the end of our interview here. I just want to thank you so much. But before we go, you know, again, this is a fantastic conversation, but I would love to hear a bit more about some of the work you're doing now, and, you know, what can we look for, you know, in the coming months and years that you're working on?
Yeah, I think we're doing a lot of fun experimental work, looking at the connections between, and I love doing, like, survey experiments. I think political science has really gotten this bug about 10 to 15 years before we have as sociologists. And I think we are playing catch up, which I love doing, and I want to be a part of that. To be able to understand how kind of race and religion and national identity intersect in ways that are powerful and effective politically. And so we've got work coming out in psychological science. I've got some survey experiment research that is under review right now, where we look at how religious views and beliefs are primed to shape people's attitudes about climate change in the ways that they either embrace or reject those kinds of ideas. So I think experimental research methodologically, I think, is the next level, so that we can actually make robust calls to names that I think are fun and important to be able to make. I also think this kind of the future of where democracy is headed in our hyper-polarized environment and religion's role to play in that. I regret that I think the Carnegie Foundation came out with recent kind of Carnegie Fellows and what they're talking. Carnegie Foundation is a group that they fund researchers to come together and collaborate on ideas and to share research. I think they funded about 30 scholars, eminent scholars of polarization around the country. And these are all the big names in polarization. I regretted to see in this year, I didn't apply for that, but I regretted to see that I don't think there was, with the exception of one scholar who doesn't necessarily study religion directly at USC and one of the only sociologists, there weren't really people studying religion's role in polarization. Mm. I feel like it's a huge mistake, right? Like, and I mean, I can't believe like that religion isn't this kind of factor that people want to dig into. But for my part, I want to dig into religion's role in amplifying and exacerbating American polarization. And I think lastly, I want to see how religion is being used to, I think, build these multi-ethnic coalitions. We've looked at how Christian nationalism divides people. But I think there's a story there about how Christian nationalism unites people in some really unfortunate ways across identity lines that I think are also politically relevant. And so I think these are things.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Sam. Thank you. I know I speak for Forrest as well, but you know, your work has been so foundational to both of our research, both of our scholarship. And we look forward to continuing the conversation with you. Thank you so much. This is wonderful. And it's great to, you know, honored to chat with you. And
same. Hey guys, I'm really excited about what you got going on. Thanks for doing this. And it's just a privilege to be included. So great. Thanks for asking.
Thank you, Sam. Take care.
Yeah. I'll see you.